all over the world telling me my stupid comments after class are more important than what I say in class. So I can't win. Vic, you don't have a helicopter? You couldn't get it? You couldn't, even with a helicopter, you couldn't get here. The police couldn't get the helicopter up in the air yesterday because of the weather. So that's why you don't have an accurate account of how many people were actually there.
I can tell you a lot.
Well, but the question is, do you hear 300,000, 400,000, 500,000, 600,000? One paper today said 800,000 from the Haredi papers. So, honestly, it's under 400,000.
It's more than each
Anyway, on the other matter, the private matter we spoke about with a shidduch for someone, I want to talk with you. Just remind me after class, okay? Because I may have something going. All right. Today is March 3rd. It's second day Rosh Chodesh. It's real Rosh Chodesh. It's real Avda. We should be getting drunk now and drinking and l'chaim, and it should be Mishenich Masada Marvim B'Simcha, 2014, to the best of my knowledge, okay? And it's a Monday morning, and once again, a happy good morning, Chodesh Tov, to those in front of me and to those listening around the world. Now, we have a world to do today and some interesting material. First of all, I have to tell you that my Talmud, Steve Gross, picked up this volume for me that came out in the last few months. It's called A Sukkah Is Burning by Professor Philip Fishman. First of all, I highly recommend, it's an easy read, but it's a memoir on Williamsburg, his own life story basically, and it raises many issues that we've discussed over the years in class. We're basically on the same burner, although I can't say I agree with everything. You know, there's certain nuances of difference between us, but the issues are real, and it's a very worthwhile volume to read. What's interesting is on page 54, you have the correct version. When I was a sophomore in high school, I attended the midnight shlichat services of Cantor Moshe Kosubitsky in Temple Beth El. Okay? And in parentheses, this magnificent Orthodox temple is now known as Young Israel Beth El. And the rest of the story is here. But here you have the details, and they are correct. And the Rakefet, by quoting, can't get into trouble this time. Max, the last time I quoted was from an article he wrote in the 1990s that preceded the book. He thanks the editor of the magazine for allowing him to print that chapter in the book. But he had his information wrong, and all over the world they were shooting at me because I was quoting him. But here I have something much more powerful. As far as what I said about the Chazanim not being tzaddikim, so you know, you got to be careful what you say. I never mentioned any names, but all right, on page 79, you have it all. His older brother is a musmach of Teira Vadas. My older brother recently related to me the following incident that took place in the 1940s as an emblematic, am I pronouncing it right, of the dramatic changes and resultant strains taking place at that time as the community was beginning to move in this more pious direction. The major annual fundraising event for the U Street Shul was a Sabbath morning choral service led by a leading cantor and his choir. This year, the cantor was the famous Moshe Aisha, who was also well known as a popular star of Yiddish theater and film. As was the custom of many years, the shul sold the tickets to the event during the prior weeks, and many of the ticket holders would show up on the Sabbath of the event, ticket in hand, to gain admission to the performance. To the more devout segment of the community, this practice of hand-carrying the admission tickets to shul was considered a transgression of the Shabbat. This was many decades before the era of the community, era of allowing Sabbath observers to carry on the Sabbath. I was informed by a friend whose father was president of the shul during the 1930s. That anyone who attended services at the U Street Shul on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur also brought their prepaid tickets with them to be inspected at the door in order to gain admission. The Sabbath morning of the Moshe Isha concert, one of the more colorful of the pious personalities, a clothing salesman named Chaim Gelb, organized a demonstration in front of the shul and physically prevented the ticket holders from entering. Soon fistfights broke out between the shul's officers and the demonstrators, and the police were called in to subdue what had become a riot. Cantor Osha arrived by limousine on Sabbath morning, and as was his custom, had the car discreetly parked two blocks away. He arrived by foot at the height of the melee, assessed the situation, and beat a rapid retreat to his car, leaving behind his forlorn choir and angry ticket holders and shul officers. So my dear students, I stand on my point. When I related the story of the chazan under the talus with the sandwich, I hate to tell you which chazan they attributed to, but since I'm not an eyewitness, I'll leave it to your imagination. Now, coming back to much more serious material, there was one aspect of Devar Hatzalah which I didn't touch upon. I didn't touch upon it purposely. I allude to it and I deal with it in a different context in Washington. But it's a, there's certain problems in life to which you can really never find a black and white solution. And Professor Juni questioned me and called his brother in Mexico and got details. So I want to raise the problem and I want to deal with it. On the internet today, an unbelievable amount of material is surfacing. People certain times feel they discovered America. I'll give you a simple example. We spoke about it in class that after World War II, they wanted to organize a college in Brooklyn. Mr. Mendelovich, Rabbi Hirtner, Rabbi... what was his name? The son-in-law of Rabbi Lessin, the one who left so many tapes. Avigdor Miller, exactly. He signed. Rabbi Gedalia Shor signed, and people can't believe this. So I noticed in the blog, the people blogging him, if I'm using the right term, someone blogged in, "What are you talking about? Rabbi Rakefet discussed this years ago," and I plead guilty. Of course I know about this, and I discussed it years ago, absolutely. But in the internet, you find material. Now, you take Lakewood, and you take Chabad. You're dealing with, I don't know how intense the feelings are today, but when I learned the Lakewood already in the early 50s, there was tremendous enmity from Lakewood to Chabad. It goes back to Europe, it goes back to Hasidus, it goes back to Chabad, and I can give you one tangible example that evidently happened in the 1940s, and when I learned Lakewood in the early 50s, it was still real, it was still spoken about. And I've spoken about this in great depth. I don't like to repeat myself, but it's probably I spoke about this 15 years ago in the context of the history of Torah in modern times, the three and a half, four years I devoted to that topic. You take the Chumash. Look how many different pshatim we can give on a pasuk in Chumash. Look how we can deal with pshat and drash and remes and sod, and no one will say boo. Whatever your cup of tea is, I once showed in class that the Rav and Rav Hirsch and the Sfat Emet all say the same shot in a pasuk in Shmot. And I said, this is fabulous that three gedolim from three different points of view, from Pardes right in front of us, same shot. But sometimes we wind up with very different pshatim. Hashtiyah kadat, Enol Neis, Gematrias, Rashi Tevot, the count, what do they call that whole the Russians are heavily involved in that, that you count the words in the Torah and you can show a system. Alright. What's it called?
Codes.
The codes in the Torah. I have to be honest, I personally am not turned on by any of this. I'm a good Jew because I saw the Shanghai crowd, I saw Gedolei Yisrael, and I've now lived 3,500 years, and I want to be sure they're going to be good Jews walking the face of the earth 3,500 years from now. So that's why I'm a good Jew. But there are people that are inspired, and I always have that open approach. If you're inspired by it, Gesundheit. Tell me, can you give Pardes to the Gemara? Shoshanaga chetapara. We're dealing with Abba Avot Nezikin. How do you explain that? It deals with torts. Let me use a fancy word. Torts. Nezikin. A shah, not over a pa. How do you explain that? Alright. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, evidently in Brooklyn, one Shabbos in the early 40s, said over a Hasidic Shavuot, and there's an entire sferim on this, by the way, put out by Moshe Rav Kook, that Shah Shanach Achetapara is the Yetzahara knocking into the Yetzah HaTov. And the Yetzahara is very powerful. It's a big shar. And the Yetzah Tov is a little para. And on that, the Lubavitcher Rebbe built the whole discourse. They related this to Rabbaran, and Rabbaran's reaction was apikursus, plain and simple. Now, the messianicism, which is going to be a very interesting issue, there's a 20th anniversary, 20th yard site of the Rebbe's death this summer, so Jewish Action is coming out with they tell me the entire issue will be devoted to the memory of the Rebbe. So they asked me to write on the Rebbe on the Rav, but to leave out anything about messianicism. So some of you know I wrote, and I had a real problem because Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Grach, my classmate, has spoken out against Chabad and messianicism. And I told the editor, please fine-tune a certain footnote. I told them how to do it, because I have to show the world I'm aware of what Reb Chaim wrote, even though I'm not dealing with it in the article. So you see, there's a lot of tension here. Do we have a right Shah Shanaga Chetapara? Think about it. I'll give you a classic example, maybe the most famous example of all. It goes back to the early Rebbeim in Hasidus. Me'aymatai korin et hashma shel arvit. Right? That's the way Shas begins, right? What time do you read the Shema of Arvit? Me'aymatai korin et hashma. When do you begin? When do you begin? Yosef Mordechai. You have to know what time. If people want to go to sleep. You live in Helsinki, the White Nights, Leningrad. Meimatai Karinet Tashma. And Rav Shmuel Shmelkes said Pshat. So a Litvak said to Rav Shmuel Shmelkes, the Pshat is Meimatai. What time? Rav Shmuel Shmelkes started yelling at him and screaming at him. What are you talking about? Chas v'chalila. Me'ematai. Me'ema umiyira korin et hashma shel arvit. Right or wrong? Go ahead. What do you want to say? Me'ema umiyira. Alright. Is that the pshat? I ask you. Some of you were professors. You taught science. You taught psychology. Tell me, you'd play games and touch up a mathematical equation like that? Alright, this is, by the way, Chizdai, I think is the name of the author. Moshe Rav Kook has an entire book on Hasidic interpretations of Shas. And Rav Aaron went hysterical. Now, then there's the messianic overtone. Now, this is a very delicate issue. Chaim Meiselman, where's Chaim? Chaim, there you are. You were sitting there yesterday. I looked there. Okay, I apologize. You have switched me. Many Michaim Smali Gabriel. Chaim Eiffel made a seam in Zvachim yesterday. So right away we all said, this is good. We're learning Kachim. I think YU has a Kachim Kollel today. Chavetz Chaim instituted a Kachim Kollel. The Chavetz Chaim, we have to be ready when Mashiach comes. Who will paskin the shilas in the Beis HaMikdash? Who will know? Kabonat, lakriv, kabonat, etc. I don't have to tell you. אני מאמין באמונה שלמה בביא את המשיח, ואף הפי שיתממה בכל זה, אחר כולו בכל יום שיבוא. All right, Lubavitch, and it's not just Lubavitch. I've seen video clippage from Poland in the 1930s, where they're singing about their Rebbeim, Yechi Adoneinu Moreinu Rabbeinu Melech HaMashiach Li'olam Ve'ed. The way a chassid relates to a Rebbe, all right. So Lubavitch, there is no question, there was the messianic overtone. And as I mentioned yesterday in class, in this book, I couldn't believe my eyes. He tells the story of, I believe it's Rav Lazar, who owns Russia today. He and Putin own the world today, you understand? There's no opposition, Obama, it's a joke. It's a joke what's going on. We have a gentleman here who has relatives in Kiev, in the Ukraine. If I were your relatives, I would run out as quickly as possible and sweep the streets of Jerusalem, but at least be safe, because it ain't going to be a good ending there. But in Rabbi Lazar's father, in other words, the chief rabbi of all of Russia, who Putin sits at his feet and learns Tanya with him, the chief rabbi of all of Russia, Beryl Lazar, his father came into Williamsburg to teach Tanya in the early 50s. And a young teenager named Yisrael Belsky, this is the famous Rabbi Belsky of today, threw him out, wrestled him to the ground in the shul. Chas v'chalila beat the hell out of him. You're not teaching in Pircha Agudat Yisrael. You're not coming to talk about the Rebbe. You're an Epicurus. You're a Messianist. You're this, you're that. That's the early 50s. Yisrael Belsky. Wow. Now I can understand why Reb Heschel one time had a big battle with him in the base Knesset, in the base Medrash, some of you may recall, over Chabad Messianicism. I don't know. The Chabadnikim I deal with, very normal, wonderful, down-to-earth people. All right, could be the Messianic style. I've occasionally met a Messianist. It's sad, but the Rubam Kekulam that I know walk with their feet on the ground. All right, the Rebbe was the Rebbe, no two ways about it. But you see, there was a lot of tension in the Chabad-Rabbaran relationship. Now, I'll explain what's surfacing, and I here have to come to Washington. Malka and I have a mitzvah, which I don't believe anyone else in this room has. By the way, the source, I was correct. Remember you asked me the Ramah? Shin Lametet, Sivkot and Dalet. Pass it to Yitzhubin, so he can check it out. That's from yesterday's shir. Suddenly I had a good memory. I remember I was talking with a tshuva of the Ramah, Kuf Kaf Hey, I said it reflects in his plaque. So Yitzhak asked me, well, I don't have it in front of me. I said, Shin Lametet. I looked it up this morning. I was right. Shin Lametet. I don't have a memory like that. I'm not Rebaron Lichtenstein, but I was right this time. Shin Lametet, Sivkot and Dalet. So, Mark and I have a mitzvah that no one else here has, and very few people have this mitzvah. We have a mitzvah of pidyon shvuyim, certified by the Mossad. It didn't come easily, but we had the mitzvah. Now, when I got involved after our first visit to Russia, we came back shell-shocked. And the reason is very simple, that ringing in my ears were the words of my Rebbe, of Slach lo nevini ki chatanu, al chet she chatanu lefanecha, she shemanu et kol tzakat achenu bei rapa v'lo asinu dai v'lo asinu maspik. And you all know, one of my earliest memories of life is riding the Third Avenue L with my father, Zichrono Livracha, and saying to my father, how can we be at ease and laugh if hundreds of thousands of Jews are being butchered every day in Europe? I was a kid, it was 44, let's say. And that's one of my earliest memories of life. So when the Mossad tapped us on the shoulder, I said, Malka said yes, and that made me say yes. I can't go into more detail now. But when you get involved with Hatzalah, who are you going to save? You're going to save 3 million Russian Jews? Or are you going to save one? If you go for 3 million, you save nobody. Plain and simple. If you go for one, you might have a chance. Of course, then I had to answer questions, and I always cite, I had a very close friend who had a, life was tragic. Rabbi Dr. Professor Tzvi Groner, if any of you recall Tzvi, he was my dear friend, he was Chaim Soloveitchik's dear friend, he was, his uncle was the Rebbe's right hand, he comes from a Chabad, he's related to the Alter Rebbe, he was an enigle of the Alter Rebbe, Tzvi Groner, Leibel Groner's nephew, Yaakov Groner's son. So Tzvi, we're walking home from the Kotel Friday night, and Tzvi says to me, who gave you the right to choose this family? Why not that family? Why not that family? For all I know, Yosef Mordechai had cousins in Moscow who were in refusal. Why didn't I choose them? So I said to Tzvi, I had enough seichel to say to Tzvi, if I start working for 10 families, I'll get no one. One family, I have a chance. Why that family? I said, Hashgacha Pratik. That's the family we met. That's the family we were so impressed with. It was a tragic situation. A person in refusal. When we met him, he was in refusal for 7-8 years already. He finally got out in 85. So when he finally got out, he was in refusal for about 12 full years. And with little children, Russia. Sad. Okay. You have to choose. You cannot win. We come back to the Kastner train. You all know that Kastner was assassinated on the streets of Tel Aviv. Someone shot him. Person was on trial, went to jail, got out of jail afterwards. And the hatred against Kastner, very simple. Adam Karov Eichel Atzmo. When he had to choose, what was it, 1,300 people for the sealed train. So he chose at random, as we said, the Noah's Ark theory. And then you choose your own relatives. And I want to tell you, I pressed Rebbe against the wall. I've written on this. I've published on this. It appears in my Kafir Aram. I've lectured on it. I've been criticized from my point of view, and I never answered. A lady from this Chevron Rosh Yeshiva's family, you all know who I'm talking about, a great lady, Dr. Farbstein. So she takes issue with me. She's wrong. I'm right. My student said to me, why don't you write? And I said, we're coming from two different worlds. She can't understand that the Kavna Rav may have done something against Halacha. But the Rav said to me, he would have passed him exactly the same way. You know, it's a question of giving a list to the Gestapo who is infirm. And he was giving a list to kill people. If you didn't give the list, they would have killed more. It's a very delicate question. The Rav said I would have acted the same way. When it comes to family, who are you going to choose? Is there anyone in this room who would not choose their mother, their father, their brother, their sister? All right, you might not choose your in-laws. That's a different story. The difference between in-laws and out-laws, that the latter are wanted. But all right, I want you to know I would have chosen my in-laws too. Baruch Hashem, what's the difference? I had whatever fights I had in the first rabbi, I never had a fight subsequently. Whenever I can compromise, I'll compromise. I don't compromise halacha, but I always realized there are other viewpoints out there. Yesterday, 400,000 people demonstrated, and Aaron Rakefin and Rabbi Rubin were sitting here against the demonstration. All right, are we right or wrong? I think I'm right, but I can't tell you with certainty I'm right. There's other viewpoints out there. Here, Rabbi Miller went to the demonstration. I didn't go. Rabbi Bednarz didn't go. All right, who's right? Who's wrong? Baruch Hashem, these are not easy questions. But whenever you're involved in Hatzalah, Kastner made enemies. Why did you choose your father, your mother, your friend's father, your friend's mother? Why didn't you choose my people? Well, if you're not going to choose, you're not going to save anyone. And once you choose, the Pandora's box is open. Now, there is a lot of resentment against Rav Aaron, and there are documents that when the Vach Hatzalah had to make certain decisions, the Lubavitchers lost out. Remember that until Rav Aaron came to America, Reb Lazer Silva ran the show. Reb Lazer Silva was a much broader person than Reb Aaron. He had been in the rabbinate, he was a gong, he was an American-made gong. Someday I'll talk about him in detail. He's probably the first gong who became a Gaon in America. In other words, Rabbi Aaron came to America a Gaon. Rabbi Mori Rebbe came to America a Gaon. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky came to America a Gaon. But Rabbi Yehuda Leifoya came to America a Gaon Shebegoinim. Rabbi Leiser Suva, I told you, ran away from Europe. You know why he ran away? He was the Dushtata Rav's son. And he had a Nilusha cup. He walked into the library in the Strassun library in Vilna, the biggest rabbinic library in all of Europe. Hitler Yamashma ended it all. And there was a young girl, a pretty sweet young girl, a librarian. He married her. So they started talking. The Shtata Rav Zun, Anna Shidduch, falls in love, marries. She died young, but people tell me she was a fabulous lady and a real Eshet Chayil. Wow. So he figured, you know, why do I have to stay in Europe and have people criticize me? He went to the land of opportunity, already had relatives there. And then he tried to make a living, became an insurance salesman, went bankrupt. You know, the usual story when Rabbanim try to make a living. I can give you a whole list of Gedolei Yisrael who didn't do well in the business world, but did very well in learning. So he then went into the rabbinate. So he's a little shtaller in Harrisburg. He was there from like 1907 to 1925. And all those years, finished a little shtaller, labriot. He sat and learned till 1-2 o'clock in the morning. He became a gadol in America. And that's why Reb Moshe, when the Rav, the famous story I always tell that I heard from the Rav a number of times, privately and publicly, he spoke about it publicly as well, when he came into the room to give his first drasha in America, and everyone knew the Gaon, Reb Moshe had been boasting who his son is, my Zun, the Gaon. And you know, students are cynical. Yeah, Gaon, clean shaven guy, what kind of Gaon, what kind of this? So the Rav walks in and Reb Moshe tells him beforehand, my Zun, my son, listen to me. You're going into the room, you're going to see the room filled with nice looking Rabbanim, Zayashin Rabbanim, the Rabbanisha Kleida with rabbinic clothes. Don't be impressed by them. If they didn't have good memories, they would know nothing. None of them are open to Gemara since they arrived in America. But since the Eina Kleina, one little guy will be sitting there in that cylinder. From him, Dapin Chadn Meira. And Reb Leiser Suva comes over to the Rav after the Shia, gives him Shalom Aleichem. The Rav told me this, that he sticks a note into the Rav's hand. The Rav puts it in his pocket, he gets home, he looks at the note, 7-8 tremendous questions on his Shia. And the Rav became very, very close to Reb Leiser Suva. Reb Aaron Suva, who teaches at KBY, is a grandson of Reb Leiser, a Talmud of the Rav. So Reb Leiser was much broader. But when Reb Aaron became the dominant force in Var Hatzalah, there is no question that if it came to a choice of saving a Litvisher or saving a Chabadnik, he chose the Litvisher. Should we criticize him for that? Absolutely not, in my opinion. Whenever you're involved in Hatzalah, if you don't make the choices, you lose out. The choices, are they good? Absolutely not. If it's your mother who you save, your mother will be happy. But the people whose mothers you didn't save, you see, Kastner was killed on the streets of Tel Aviv. It's, by the way, his granddaughter is a member of the Knesset today. She's got a big mouth. She's a Grace Piska. But that's her grand. That's the granddaughter. What's her name? She was on TV. She was a TV personality. I don't think I ever knew her name. Meirav Michaeli, I believe, is the name. Anyone can correct me or check me out. Meirav Michaeli, I believe, is the name. Don't go into more detail. She was close to Yitzchak Rabin. She interviewed him. She crawled on his desk. It was a picture. She was criticized. I didn't know it was Kastner's daughter, but she has been in the headlines over the years. Okay. Now, Sam asked me another question, and I have to tell you, I can prove he's absolutely right. I can prove he's absolutely right. Another person became very active in the Var Hatzalah, Rav Avram Kalmanovich. Now, Rav Avram Kalmanovich was, if we're going to give out the numbers, Rav Aaron Cutler was one, Rav Lezer Silva was two, Rav Avram Kalmanovich was three. Rav Avram Kalmanovich was president of Mir in Poland. Not a Rosh Yeshiva. I'm telling it as it was. He was a great Lamdan, he was a Shtut Rav, and he was a Klautua. And he was president. He was in charge of fundraising, publicity, Mir. And he gets to America, and he throws himself into terrific Hatzalah work. He knew a little English, and he's the famous story where they go to Morgenthau, a reform assimilated American Jew, and he cries bitterly that you must help us save Jews. And he brought the Morgenthau family back to Jewish identity, Rav Avram Kalmanovich. He later reopens Mir in America, and he becomes the Mir Rosh Yeshiva in America. Now, what happened to Mir? Everyone winds up in Kobe, Japan. The Japanese are under pressure from the Germans, who are now their allies, kill every last Jew. To the credit of the Japanese, they did not kill one single Jew. You all remember what I quoted to you last week, how the Yamshanov Rebbe said when he asked, why do the Germans hate you? The Lamshirov was speechless, and the Yamshanov Rebbe said, we are Orientals. First they'll hate us. When they're finished with us, Labriyot, they're going to hate you. So the Japanese, but what do? You can't let them stay around Japan. So they came up with the solution of Shanghai. Now, those who were world famous and could get out of Japan, many went on from Kobe to Palestine or to America or to Canada. Rabbi Aaron Cutler went on to America. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky goes on to Canada. Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Finkel Demir Rosh Yeshiva goes on to Yerushalayim. But over 400 Mir Yeshiva boys wind up in Shanghai. And as I told you, there was a shul there, and the shul had little over 400 seats, barely had a minyan shabbos, and suddenly every seat is filled. There's the famous picture of the shul with the yeshiva boys. Every last seat was filled. But what are you lacking? You have a yeshiva, you have yeshiva boys. You have a shul. You need svarim. And they were pleading with Rav Avram Kalmanovich, Mir. He's their president. Help us with money. We want to print svarim. Have with what to learn. At the same time, Rav Weissmandel, who was involved with Hungarian Hatzalah, Dovbe Weissmandel, later Mount Kisco. You all know Rabbi Weissmandel was dealing with Himmler, dealing with German leaders, trying to buy out Jews, Hungary. He's the one who ultimately succeeds in getting some out. But he needs money, bribes. Trucks he has to buy. He pleads with Rav Kalmanovich, don't waste your money on printing svarim. Give the money to me. Rav Avram Kalmanovich, who probably considered by 1944 what Weissmandel is talking about to be quixotic, I'll use that word. Quixotic. What svarim they need? What you're looking at is a Gemara Eruvin, Shanghai, 1944. Okay? When we still had money here, and why you cared about their Israeli division, I was talking with the person who ran the institution here, Mr. Howard Weisband, and we agreed we were going to get a case and get some advice how we can preserve. As you see, the paper is falling apart. And before you know it, he was out, and the whole institution here, we suffer until today. But that's a story unto itself beyond my comprehension. But in life, there are a number of matters I've bumped into that are beyond my comprehension. That's one of them. Who's right in this story? Who's right? You called your brother. Your brother gave you the details. These are facts. You're absolutely right. This is Shanghai, 1944. The money could have been used in dealing with the Germans, Hungary. Could have, would it, had they succeeded. And yes, maybe one life is worth more than 1,000 Gemaras, 400 Gemaras. But you see, these are such difficult decisions. With hindsight, we can be a lot smarter. With foresight, no one knows for sure. We don't believe in Das Torah. This concept of Das Torah is non-Jewish. It's nothing to do with Torah, with the Jewish people. Gedolei Yisrael are Gedolei Yisrael. But we're human beings. We're caught up in a quagmire. We're caught up in a certain reality. So I have to tell you, don't respond to these charges as Oddscroll would. Can't be. Never happened. They're making it up. It happened. It's real. Do we have easy solutions? Absolutely not. Here. Yeah. You see, Obama challenged Netanyahu this morning. Last night already was on the news. Obama said it in diplomatic language, but what he was saying was very simple. Netanyahu, if you're so smart and you don't like giving the Arabs back, giving away all of Israel and giving away Jerusalem, how are you going to make peace? How are you going to make peace? Give us a plan. Give us a plan. What are you going to do? Well, take a look. When we left Gush Katif, all the politicians, Tzipi Livni, our position in the world will be better than ever. Every country will love us. Word by word, we were yelling and shouting, they're going to shoot missiles. Take a look what happened with Gush Katif. Foresight, hindsight. Did the politicians mean well? I hope so. Save Jewish lives? I hope so. I can't believe that Rav Ovadia is a Russian, Marusha, or Oslo. He's talking to save Jewish lives. Look what came out of Oslo. Look how many deaths came out of Oslo. Look how much has to be spent in defense. You have any idea the budget, what goes on daily? All right, these are difficult decisions. The facts are correct. Who is right, who is wrong? I don't believe there's a black and white answer, but each one can have their point of view. Okay, let me go a drop further now. So we saw last week Mr. Irvin Bunim. I think we had a very momentous session that Mr. Bunim's daughter attended class. She's not a youngster. I know her by many different names. I know her as Bunim. I know first marriage was Reuben. Second marriage was Pupko, the Chavetz Chaim's great nephew. They were both. She was a grushai, he was widowed. He died young, and they were both widowed. Dr. Asabel, very happy new marriage for him and for her, Kanai and Hara. I taught three out of her four children, and I'm very angry at America. Am I right or wrong? She has one son. I mean, I taught Moshe, I taught Eli. Moshe, right, is a cardiologist. The big hospital in Washington Heights, Columbia Presbyterian. Her son Eli, Talmud Mufak of Merkaz Harav, what a young man, what a machanech. And Rabbi Lukstein, Haskell Lukstein, picked him up, brought him to America, never left America. Ramaz, Now he's at Frisch, he's the dean, he's the head figure. Terrific ability. I don't know, he left Israel. I would have been a lot happier had he remained here and in Chinuch. What an individual. Alright, but this leads us to another question. Jews are in the Golah. How do we take care of them? Alright, I have my own point of view. It's not for now. I have the Rakefet solution that I think solves not all problems, but 90%. Now, so Rabari missed the Bunim, and we ended off a drop about Lakewood. Why Lakewood? And remember, Lakewood began, I would say, Bal Kacha of Rabarin. Rabarin was really not that interested at first. The Tatzala work was overwhelming, but after White Plains failed and the Rav Maharesh Yeshiva didn't succeed, they turned to Rabarin and he agreed, fine. And why Lakewood? Never forget the source I gave you last week. It's a new book that just came out. Rabbi Nissim Waxman. See, it's Min HaShemayim. You had a modern Orthodox congregation in Lakewood, and the rabbi was a Litvisher Talmud Chacham, although Americanized. Rabbi Waxman was Americanized. He spoke English. Well, of course, his native language was Yiddish. He's the father of Professor Chaim Waxman. So you can understand what happened and why Rabarin agreed to go to Lakewood. Here he had a rabbi that he had, be a Brit Meduberet, Safam Mishutefet. They spoke the same language. And Lakewood had the other advantages, a quiet community. When I learned in Lakewood, they told me that there is no college, I think, within 100 miles of Lakewood. That also, it turned out there's an agricultural college not that far from Lakewood, at least in the time I learned in Lakewood. But show me how many yeshiva boys have gone to agricultural college. In Israel, it's a different story. Here, Rehovot with the leaders of agriculture in the world. But when I learned in Lakewood, an agricultural college did not count. Now, I want to go further and show you eyewitness accounts of Rabban. And here I'm going to show you something very fascinating that takes us back to what we spoke about a minute ago with choosing in Hatzalah. And I'm quoting from a magazine, which is not exactly, I wouldn't say gets the Pulitzer Prize for honesty and integrity. This is Ami magazine, which came out to rival Mishpacha. And if on a scale of 1 to 10, in other words, if Mizrahi is 1 and the Agudat Yisrael is 10, so Mishpacha is about 6, 7. Ami is 9-10. You understand? There's a big difference. But there's a very interesting interview here. It's about from Shneur Cutler. All this ties in with Lakewood's, with Rav Aaron Cutler's 50th Yahrzeit. And here they have an interview with Rav Shneur's widow, Rishel Cutler. Rishel Cutler, I think it's pronounced in Yiddish. That she should live and be well. She is the surviving Rebbetzin of Reb Shneur. But I knew Reb Shneur very well. I mean, I have to tell you honestly, on a scale of 1 to 10, Mizrahi being 1 and Agudat Yisrael being 10, the Reb Shneur I knew was on 3 or 4, not more. He was closer to Mizrahi than I believe Agudat Yisrael. He said it to me openly. He said, when I learned in Eretz Yisrael, and my father-in-law, my Shver, Rabbi Sazama Meltzer, much closer. Then, you know, the world does what it does, and we all know what happened in America. But anyway, this interview was very fascinating. I believe it's by the editor of Ami, Rabbi Yitzchak Frankfurter. And he describes the Rebbetzin. The Rebbetzin is astute as ever. Even her cutting sense of humor seems to be intact. The home is bustling with children. Every few minutes, another vivacious grandchild seems to come through the door. And she gives her life story. By the way, here you see a picture. Here's Reb Aaron, and right next to him is Reb Lazer Silva. It has to be at a wedding, and you see Reb Lazer Silva with his hi-hat, the tzulinda. Reb Lazer was very short, and when he wore tzulinda, he was even shorter than Reb Aaron. He was shorter than Reb Moshe, but when he wore tzulinda, it gave him height. And she tells the story, her father had been a Talmud in Slutz, her father learned by Rabbi Zalman, her father learned by Rabbaran Kutla, her father was a first-rate Talmud Chacham, and then he left the yeshiva and became a businessman and very successful. And of course, they criticized him leaving the yeshiva, but when he became successful, the main character in Torah, I imagine the criticisms were mitigated. And she tells the story of how they ran away. They ran away to Vilna, and Reb Shneur was in Vilna, and Reb Elchanan Wasserman made the shidduch between her and her father's chaver's son, Reb Aaron's son. Now, she winds up in Shanghai. Reb Shneur, Reb Aaron, when he gets out, puts tremendous heat on his father-in-law, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer uses all his contacts in Eretz Yisrael, and they're able to get a visa for Reb Shneur to Yerushalayim, to Palestine. So he goes on to Palestine. Imagine she is a kala caught in Shanghai for who knows how long. Now, when Reb Aaron, I'm quoting this to you, you'll see what we just spoke about. When Reb Aaron was in America, he sent money to Shanghai through the Red Cross. He sent the extra money to me and wrote it was from him, explaining that he did not want to allot klal money to an eigene kind, his own child from his family, which is why he specified that it was his personal money. It wasn't a lot, but it was enough for basic food, of which there was a shortage in Shanghai. So you see here too, you're sending money. You're a Baron Cutler. For the sake of argument, you're sending $100,000 to help the hundreds and hundreds of mere refugees that are caught in Shanghai. Your daughter-in-law-to-be is caught there. Add a few dollars for her. What would you do? An Egan. It's your daughter-in-law. I have granddaughters-in-law there. I only have daughters, so I have no daughters-in-law. But Baruch Hashem, I have today, I don't want to start counting, but I believe I have 5 granddaughters-in-law. Granddaughters-in-law are like my children, of course. I give each one a birthday gift like I give a grandson. An egana. Add a few pennies, no? So if you add to $100,000 that you're sending over, you say, and out of the $100,000, please give $2,000 to this lady who's related to me. Would you criticize? Understand? It's a difficult issue. But Reb Aaron, according to what she says, it's her testimony. She's no gadbadav. I can't say I can accept it in a court of law, but she says he made clear to me that the extra, for the sake of argument, $1,000 that he sent is out of his pocket. It's not Vad Hatzala money. Now, she describes Reb Aaron, and once again, the word I used a few weeks ago is the only word that can be applied to him. Why was he so successful? The Bren! Reb Aaron's entire avoda was the Varat Salah. He didn't stop until the last DP camp was closed. I'll talk about that next week, Bezrat Hashem. He was always busy saving people, resettling people, children, adults. He didn't eat, he didn't sleep. The whole day was devoted to the Varat Salah. I never saw such a harabanya, absolute dedication in my life. He fought a war to wake up American Jews to the cause. He went into houses and screamed at people to get involved, to do something. He screamed at them to donate to the cause. He could be heard in people's apartments speaking to them from behind closed doors. He yelled. He pounded on the table. He cried. And she goes on to say, and this is why he never moved to Lakewood. He couldn't move to Lakewood. In the early years of the yeshiva, he only went there for Shabbos. He gave 2 shiurim on Shabbos. But by the way, it's very bad to give a shiur on Shabbos, because students can't write the shiurim down. And that's the famous story in Kamenetz that I spoke about. No, you know the story or not, in the Musa movement, where in Kamenetz they found one of the top students in the yeshiva. Rosh Baruch Beh gave a shiur Friday night, and there sits in his room, and he's writing the shiur up on Shabbos. It's a classic story. And he was thrown out of the yeshiva. But the Musa, I dealt with it within the context of Musa. You want to know about that story? I told that story to my students when I was a young Rebbe in a yeshiva that was much younger than it is today, didn't have all the bad publicity. Yeah, I don't know, I never heard of one scandal when I was a student in YU. The only scandal I heard of was 1935, which had nothing to do with YU per se, but it was a scandal that took place on the premise of the yeshiva. I spoke about it here in class last year, revealed it for the first time, so people shouldn't come up with documents and think that Rakefet didn't know about it. There are reasons why I couldn't publish about it, but the know about it, I know about it. But it's nothing to do with YU. But the 60s, 7 years, it was a Rebbe till I went in Aliyah, and not one word of scandal. And I was telling the class that Torah is not just myology, it's not just like chemistry, it's not something you just study for the sake of knowledge. Torah you study for Yirat Shemayim, for feeling, for emotion, for commitment, for dedication, for a word I use today that I didn't know then, for the romance of the Jewish people, of being part of the Torah people. So I told this story of this kid writing in Kamenetz on Shabbos. The next day, Rabbi, one of the kids in my class, his father comes to see me, and Yerupeyesh Rav in the Bronx, he hugs me. He says, "How do you know this story? How do you know?" He says, "Ich hab gewen, Gott, ich hab gewen, a Talmud. Ihr seid ein Amerikaner." He said, "How do you know?" He couldn't believe it. I told him, the story happened in the 30s when I learned in Lakewood. I heard the story. I told him. I heard living evidence from people in Lakewood. Either they were in Kamenetz or the whole yeshiva, Satumel, Zarash, and Baruch Hashem. I don't know what became. Who knows what became of that individual? I don't know the name. I don't know what became of him. But Rabbarin to say shir on Shabbos, very bad. I was once caught in the rabbinate in Los Angeles. They mamish asked the shayla if they can bring a guy to record me. They wanted to record me on Shabbos. So bring a guy. Tzorech haratan, tzorech mitzvah. Min ken lerenin, min ken oiskere. You can come up with a nice heta. Take my word for it. Tzorech mitzvah. What's the difference? The guy knows in advance. You're not telling him on Shabbos. You're telling him during the week. There's a whole question of amira la'aklam if you tell him before Shabbos, etc., etc. And it's a devar mitzvah lahabot Torah v'chulu v'chulu. Don't we have recordings on YouTube of Kusevitzky? Didn't someone get you gave me a link, right? That was Reb Moshe Reb David was Reb David Kusevitzky, right? What was a Musaf Kedusha of Musaf? It's on YouTube. I said it. I said the chayv. I have a shayli. Am I allowed to listen, to have enough and something recorded? So we both concluded that it had to be a guy recording him. If it was a guy recording him, all right. So it's not enough from a malacha from a Jew. It's a little bit easier, but it's very bad. Don't give if you're going to be a Rosh Yeshiva in Lakewood, I would say, don't give a shiur on Shabbos. Unless you have Talmidim, not interested in learning, let the Rebbe give a shiur. Gesunt Hate will sit there and then daydream. But the Rebbe gives a shiur, you want to take notes, you want to write it down. But he couldn't move to Lakewood. He had to be in New York. The excitement was in New York. What you could do was in New York. And then she says very correctly, it wasn't just Vahatzala. Rav Aaron became the pulsating leader of the Litvish Belt in America. And Agudat Yisrael. He gets involved, Agudat Yisrael. He gets involved with Chinuch Atzmai. He gets involved with the demonstrations against, at that time it wasn't drafting yeshiva boys, but we're going to come back to it in a few minutes, but Gias Banot, but drafting women into the army, Rav Aaron gets involved. He was a brand. He led the battles. He led the fights. This was Rav Aaron Kotler. Fine. I witness account. More. Marvin Schick. Recognize the name? Still, God should give him health and strength. Alive and kicking. I think the columns he publishes, he pays for today. No one has to do him a favor. I know him. He's an RJJ graduate. He's for many years was president of the RJJ. I believe he took over after Mr. Bunim died. You can check it out. Very famous family from Brooklyn. They had a bakery, Schick Bakery. Very well-known bakery. I don't know if it still exists today. The name, the Schick name, was a well-known bakery. I imagine the new generation already went into business. Well-known bakery. So that was his family's geschäft. Now, Marvin Schick, again, very broad individual. He's someone who could state, like Rav Lazer Silver, both Mizrahi, both Aguda were his sisters. Totally involved on the general Torah scene on the United States. He published a memoir about Rav Aaron and the Rebbe. And I want to quote from this memoir, and I want to add a drop to the memoir that he doesn't touch upon. But it's a beautiful memoir. I'm trying to see if I can tell you. It either was sent to me, I got it off a website. Marvin Schick, Remembrances and Reflections, number 8 of Rav Aaron. And this one, published April 15th, 2012, must be his own blog, Remembrance and Reflections of Rav Aaron and the Rav. And of course, this is a question which we've come to, Rabbi Rubin asked me about it, and there's no question, in my humble opinion, deciphering everything I've seen and known and spoken with the Rav's family, there was no one in America for whom the Rav had greater derech eretz than for Rav Aaron Kotler. In other words, here you had two litvish gedolim who both were lamdanim ufakim. No one could put the Rav down in learning, and no one could put Rav Aaron down in learning. They were very different. I think Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's words that I've repeated and refined and defined many times over and refined many times over are absolutely correct. Mori Rebbe was a Litvisha who attempted to translate the Lithuanian heritage to the American scene. You don't have to believe me for saying this. All you have to do is open volume 2 of the Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph P. Soloveitchik, Ellie, where the Rav talks about why he loves Yeshiva University, and you'll see this is the Rav. He's not Rav Hirsch. He's not Rav Hirsch. He explains the differences between him and Rav Hirsch, but he is a Litvak trying to translate Lithuania to America. Rav Aaron wanted no part of America, no part of Western culture, no part of college, no part of advanced degrees. Rav Aaron was taking Litta, we have to transplant it in American soil. Now, in their relationship, see, they couldn't always agree. At times they agreed, and at times they disagreed. But the mutual respect was always there. He tells this story. I've heard the story many times over, but now you have a source. You have a source. It's evidently mshikblogspot.co, etc. Evidently, am I using the right word? It's his blog, I can call it. Okay, thank you, because I'm an Amaritz when it comes to computers, outside of being able to get the Yankees. Oh, 5 minutes a day, I am a kid again. Beautiful. All problems forgotten. Ugh. Love it. Back here. Ellie, I speak Japanese already. I'm so excited. Yoni, back here. So you see, Gias Banot became a tremendous issue. Now, once again, I have to repeat what I said yesterday. No one but no one has analyzed the question of serving in the army halachically. And I corrected the rabbi, the Rosh Yeshiva of Mecca, Chaim Kantrukman, I corrected yesterday, and Naftali Bennett I corrected. It's not a mitzvah to serve in the army, it's not a skut to serve in the army, it is a chovah. Now, what's interesting is, in a Muhammad mitzvah, women have to serve too. Women have to serve too. A Talmud sent me the Lubavitcher Rebbe's defense of yeshiva boys not savoring, but that very defense is not, it really opens the door to what we have the civilian population, the Oreif. What do you mean, men and women, Chatan V'Kala, the Mishnah and Sota? So many Rishonim say it means they have to supply food and drink, logistics. No, we can use a lot of yeshiva help logistically. So, men is one issue. With women, there is a second side to the coin. And I ask your indulgence, because what I'm about to say, I don't like to talk about the topic of men and women and sex in public, but I have to be honest here. The army reflects the state of Israel. State of Israel today is Kanayin Hara on to 70-75% religious or traditional. But you have another 25% that lives like Obama. Kechol HaGoyim Beit Yisrael. And lo aleinu, men and women, sexes, just like having a drink or a meal, or God have mercy, but what we view sex, kedusha and tahara, the basis of the hayu basara chan, the secret of our life, of our happiness, they don't have this concept at all. They finally get married when the woman is pregnant, if she's lucky. There are people, Menuvalim Shabbat, Arik Sharon's son, what, the one who went to jail, what does he have, three children? No wife, no nothing. I think it's three children, two for one woman. I can't even talk about it. Sickening. So you're going to take a religious girl, put her into the army. And in the army, it's a reflection of the population. In the early 1950s, what I just said was totally incorrect. Religious and traditional early 1950s, maybe we hit 20% of the population, not 70%, 75%. It's a different world today, and the world it gets better every day. Every day it gets better, can I know? So you have a real problem. You're going to draft women. Chatan leaves his wedding, and the woman leaves the chuppah and the house of happiness. You're going to put them into the army, and you're going to expose them to a world where 75% is total hefkerut. There's another part to the army, which of course the army, this goes on all over the world. In Israel we have very strict laws. A person of command, a person of power, can take advantage of a woman, can take advantage of any soldier underneath, anyone under his command. Allah kama b'kama, he can take advantage of a woman. Now, to the credit of the State of Israel, and like going on in 1950, and I don't have to go further, just look at some of the autobiographical literature, you'll understand what I'm saying. To the credit of the State of Israel today, the very strict laws, ad kedei kach, that there was a case a few years ago where, and you have to know, I know the army from the inside, the Makal in Tel Aviv. Have you ever been in the Matekhala? You can't get in. You can only get in if you're on official business, if you're in the army, if you have the documents. So you have a general. You know what it means to have a general? You have a general, he is surrounded by six or seven people, each with a different task. His liaison, someone who runs his office, someone who runs his schedule, someone who keeps in touch with the brigadier generals, etc., etc., etc. So this general turns to this lady who's an officer working in his office and asks her to make a cup of coffee for him. Do you remember this? Headlines in every Israeli newspaper. About 10 years ago, maybe less. So she refuses. Feminism. She refuses. What am I, your slave? Make a cup of coffee? My mother would have never refused. Never. My mother worked, and I know what her relationship was with her bosses. But this is a new generation today. So the general blows his stack, and he wants to court-martial her. Siruf Pekuda goes to court, and the general, the court rules, this is not a Pekuda, this is a Bakasha. You can't command a soldier to make a cup of coffee for you. This is not basic training or the battlefield. You're making a request. She has a right to refuse. But the Beit Din sitting there said, look, for the sake of a good feeling in the office, it's not good. He's going to ask for a cup. You're going to refuse. There's going to be resentment. So they reached a compromise. One day he made the coffee and one day she made the coffee. So I have to say, in Israel today, it is infinitely, infinitely better than it was in the early 50s. Now, I know a lot more that I don't want to say, because I spoke with big Rabbanim who were involved, big Mizrahi Rabbanim from my camp, from my world, and they, every word I'm telling you is true. These were real problems. So in 53, when Ben-Gurion already had agreed to exempt yeshiva boys, and you got to remember, Ben-Gurion, without going into great detail, was a split personality. At the 100th anniversary of his birth, they had many TV programs and radio programs, and many people accused him of giving into the religious and destroying the state. It's not democratic, and marriage and divorce is in the hands of Rabbanim, and yeshiva boys don't serve in the army, and buses don't run on Shabbos, and public cafeterias are kosher. They blame Ben-Gurion. And then the question was, why did he do it? And there was a whole machlokes. Did he do it as a compromise, or did he do it because he really believed it? So you should know, many scholars felt he came from a frum home, from a Shomer Shabbos home. Like Golda Meir. If you ever saw pictures of Golda Meir's parents, her father looked like a Rosh Yeshiva from the old country. Her mother's hair was covered down to here. They had a residual feeling of commitment. He may have believed it, that despite Paula, she had a bitter hatred, and she was agnostic, a total hatred for religion. But they felt, look, it has to be a Jewish state, that he had to give in on this level. So he exempted the yeshiva boys. But Israel was a very feministic society already in the early 50s. Socialism, Mapai, communism, Russia, women work, men work, women marched, men watched. Look at the Russian propaganda out of the communist era. Equality, way ahead of America. Israel was like Russia. That's why Russia supported Israel at first. They thought that Israel would become a communist country, right or wrong. They were the third country to recognize Israel, Russia. So women, the army, women are involved in every aspect of life. Women run the kibbutzim, women work. Why not the army? So this was Yehareg V'al Yafa. Because the Gedolei Yisrael felt, and with, I have to add, with justification, it's not the army of today. Don't misunderstand me. Today, I may have a future daughter-in-law who was an officer in the army. She was an intelligence. And she was in the religious branch of intelligence where there are over, hundreds and hundreds of religious women who work in intelligence with computers, with navigation. It's no end. It's a different army today. But we're talking the early 50s. Hefkeira, you take a Beis Yaakov girl, you take a girl who was totally sheltered, and you put her into a world like this. Take a look in America, the books that are being written today by women who grew up in Satmar, women who grew up in Beis Yaakov. Take a look in Israel. I can show you articles. You can get sick. Totally sheltered. They're exposed to the big world. They're streetwalkers. I don't want to go further. Ah, so they fought Gias Bonot Bildi. So Rav Aaron came up with the idea that he wants the Rav, because you got to remember, when all is said and done, America of the 50s was not America of today. The fact that Rav Aaron Cutler spoke out, alright, he influenced a few people. The Rav already by the early 50s was a shame dava. YU was on top of the world. Young Israel was on top of the world. No one dreamt there would come a time that the Charedim, as we call them, or as they say in American popular language, the black hats. What term does the New York Times use? Did they use the term Charedim? I don't like the black hats, because you can wear a black hat, you don't have to be Charedi. But the outlook, what term did they use? Ultra-Orthodox? I don't like that term either, because I'm, whatever I believe, I'm an also ultra. I'm an ultra-religious Zionist Jew, believe me. Anyway, be it as it may, they wanted to get the Rav on their side. So I heard the story, but here you have it in writing, and he tells you what Rav Aaron came up with. Rav Aaron came up with the idea, let's hold the meeting in Rav Mendel Zaks' apartment. Why Rav Mendel Zaks? The Rav and Rav Mendel, I can testify, these eyes, these ears, they were very close. Rav Mendel, Dr. Bell, we'll talk about him. Rav Mendel comes to YU, but it's not for today, a few weeks down the line. Rav Mendel comes to YU, it's the Bochim. The Rav is in YU. They used to talk in the hallway. Rav Mendel was Bucky and all of Shas. Rav Chaim's son-in-law. The Rav, Rav Chaim's Zainikel. They used to walk up and down. I can still see the site on the first floor, Geret and Laron and Weiss, the little kids who used to hop and, you know, try to pick up what they thought. They would argue at times. So Rav Aaron Cutler had a fabulous idea. Rav Mendel Zaks' apartment, the Rav will come there. He'll come there, and they'll get the Rav to sign on. Now, watch. There was a meeting at Rav Mendel Zaks' apartment in Manhattan. Rabbi Dov Ber Weinberger, by the way, Vic, your family will know who that was. Rabbi Dov Ber Weinberger drove Rav Aaron to the meeting, and he was witness to what happened. This report, never before published, was told to, by him to me many years ago and was recently confirmed by him. In line with the usual mode of address, Rav Zaks was referred to as the Radna Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Aaron as the Kletzka Rosh Yeshiva, and the Rav as the Bostoner Rav. Now you have to understand, what are we talking about? When we get together, let's say rabbis, I get together with Rabbanim who I grew up with, we call each other by our first names, Heshi, Aaron, Ichveis, Yitz, we grew up together. But here are three world famous Rabbanim. So how do they refer to each other? I heard this with my own ears. The Radna Rosh Yeshiva, was tracht the Radna Rosh Yeshiva? I'm not asking, what do you think? What does the third person, what does the Radna Rosh Yeshiva think? You understand? It's like saying, what does the Grus Rosh Kollel think? Would you ever talk that way? That's the way they spoke. The Radna Rosh Yeshiva, the Kletzka, Rav Aaron was Kletzka, Lakewood was an insult to him, you understand? Kletzk was Kletz. Today, Lakewood is Lakewood, but then Lakewood is 75 students. How big was Lakewood? The Kletzka Rosh Yeshiva. Now the Rav, what are they going to call him? The YU Rosh Yeshiva? But the Rav, they always refer to the Boston Rav. If you look at Rabbi Shurkin, one of his early editions of the Rav's Torah, you'll see it says, Rav, I'm based in Kiela Kadosha, Boston Rav. That way you can leave out any reference to YU. So this is the way they refer to. After more than an hour of futile effort to get Rav Soloveitchik to publicly oppose Giyat Banot, Rav Aaron came up with the following brilliant idea. Of course, in Yiddish. You see, they couldn't budge the Rav. The Rav refused to come out against Israel in public. To criticize Israel? I remember when Satmar demonstrated at the consul in New York, we asked Rebbe, Rebbe said, bring me a Rambam. I've told you the story so many times. Bring me a Rambam. We bring him a Rambam. He opens up the Hilchot Tshuva, Perikimu Halachi Yeralef. Ein lehem chelik walam haba. They're a porish minitziva, a pikosim gemur. Look into the Rambam. And then the Rav says, the goyish of Welt, their hands are still wet with Jewish blood. And we should demonstrate against the state of Israel? That's a fabulous vart. So the Rav was, could very well he was against Giyuspanot, but he would not come out in public. So Rabban came up with this idea. He said, Boston Rav, imagine that instead of the three of us discussing the issue, there were another three who were judging the appropriateness of drafting girls into military service. Instead of the Boston Rav, there was Gerzei, the Rav Chaim, sitting here. Instead of the Ravna Rosh Yeshiva, there was his father-in-law, the Chafetz Chaim. Instead of me, there was my father-in-law, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, Boston Rav. What would your Zayda have said? This masterstroke did not result in a shift in Rabbi Soloveitchik's position. He got up and said he had to leave. Quote, Kletzke Rosh Yeshiva und Ratne Rosh Yeshiva a guten Tag. And he left. And he never opposed Yibanot in public, or for that matter, never opposed the Mizrahi publicly on any major Hashkafic issue. Now that's a story. I know this story. I heard this story decades ago. It's interesting. So you might think, Rav Aaron and the Rav, imagine the Rav refuses. Ellie, you want to ask something? The Rav, hold on. The Rav refuses to go along. So watch. There are other times where the Rav went out of his way to help Rav Aaron. I'll show you in a minute. Yeah, what do you want to ask?
In Rebbe lectures on the Rav in Torah Zionism, so didn't you discuss how the Rav differed with the Mizrahi on certain issues?
No, there's no question the Rav differed, but it was never public. It was within.
So what about those letters back and forth?
Yeah, but that's not public. Today, the letters are public. Who knew about those letters then?
Obviously, how did he know about his opinion if it wasn't...
No, the Rav contacted Chetzit Mizrahi, and where he differed, he told them. But he never differed with Mizrahi in public and never differed with being a Mizrahiite. That the Rav wasn't a parrot, he wasn't a parrot, you understand? That's what the Rav... Listen, if you're exposed to the Talmidim of the Rav, then I think you see right away none of us are parrots. We all have minds of our own. That's why we have such a negative attitude towards Das Teira, you understand? I could never ever take my mind and someone's going to tell me who to marry. You understand? You just came up in Beit Shemesh. That lecture in Beit Shemesh, Hofeich Galgalim. But talk with Baron Lichten, he talked with Jerry Blitzstein, talk, you know, with the kids. It's an interesting topic. But the Rav never came out from the time he became a Mizrahiite. He never came out in public against the Mizrahi. He spoke at times how hard it was for him to become a Mizrahiite, to go against his family traditions, to go against Reb Chaim. But he was a proud thinking, deep Mizrahiite, period. And this story here is fabulous, but there's another story. Rav Aaron got involved with Chinuch Atzmai. Chinuch Atzmai, today there's no problem, there's no need for money. The government totally covers the budget of Chinuch Atzmai. It's a different world, as I said. From the time Menachem Begin became prime minister, big changes began. And Chinuch Atzmai, because they get money from the government, they have to allow in the core curriculum. That's why you have Talmud Torahs where you don't have a core curriculum, but if they don't have core curriculum, they can't take money from the government. If you don't have a core curriculum, you're sinning against the children because you're raising tragic umgliks, kids who won't be able to make a living, and a good percentage of them will take the whole Yiddishkeit and throw it away. It's frightening to see. But, alright, Medaf of Masl, Medaf of Msechel. Chinuch Atzmai had to raise its own funds. Ben Gurion refused to support them. They, for years, that one time they got 50% of their operating budget, then they got more, but their buildings they didn't get. Don't ask what went on until Begin gave them everything. Chichas Mai had to have dinners. You need money. Rabbi Aaron Cutler had contacts, but no one had more contact than the Rav. Can anyone tell me why? Because the diamond dealers on the west side organized a shul for the Rav to give shiurim on. I think he had to spend one Shabbat a month there. I think also with Jomim Narayim, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think he had to be there either Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, whatever. And that, of course, was Moriah. In that shul, the Ki Balabatim were heavyweights financially. You had the whole 47th Street Brussels diamond clique there. And these people had tremendous derech eretz for the Rav. If you could get the Rav to come to a Chinuch Atzmai dinner, his presence would bring, in today's terminology, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. Not long after this incident, I believe it was, he writes, 40, 54, 55, I have exactly in the Rav, in my work on my Rebbe, I have the exact date, I think it was 55, Rav Aaron reached out again to him and enlisted him in efforts to raise funds for Chinuch Atzmai. The high point came at the first Chinuch Atzmai dinner where Rav Soloveitchik, and this is Marvin Schick speaking, made the most remarkable speech I have ever heard. Rav Henoch Cohen, who has served Chinuch Atzmai for nearly 60 years with great devotion and who, please God, is about to make Aliyah with his wife Hannah, has a disc of this memorable speech. Now, this speech is published word by word from the recording in A Fire in His Soul in the book I quoted last week on Irvin Bunin. And now he cites, well, we all heard about it. I can't say I was at the dinner, I was a kid, and where do I come to having hundreds of dollars to buy a plate to go to the dinner, 55. But we all heard about it. After explaining why he is a Mizrachiite, why he's helping Chinuch Atzmai, Rabbi Soloveitchik spoke warmly about Stephen Klein, Chinuch Atzmai's chairman and the president of Barton's Candy. He then lavished praise on Rav Aaron, comparing him in elaborate language, first to the Vilna Gaon, then to Reb Akiva Eger, and finally to his Zayda, Rav Chaim. I was standing directly behind Rav Aaron as Rav Soloveitchik spoke, and as each of these comparisons were made, Rav Aaron tugged at Rav Soloveitchik's jacket with one hand and implored him to stop with the other hand. Pounded on the table and intoned repeatedly, "Das ist nicht demes! Das ist nicht demes!" As I looked more closely at Rav Aaron, I saw he was crying. So you see, these are gedolim, they differ. You can't turn the Rav into Rav Aaron, you can't turn Rav Aaron into the Rav by any stretch of the imagination. But the respect and love is very deep. And I heard the story b'shas ma'aseh that Rav Aaron was pulling his sleeve from his jacket that he should stop speaking like that. Reit nicht das heißt. Es nicht demes, es nicht demes. But you saw what the Rav held about Rav Aaron. And I'll end off with one story I told you already a few weeks ago. But it fits right in here for the sake of being complete, accurate. You see how much derech eretz the Rav had for Rav Aaron. When big shaylot came up, life and death questions, Tshuva, Yom Kippur, David Weingarten. Remember I told you the story? David Weingarten, who was in the travel business. Big Mizrachiite. Chorev, high school for girls, he built it. It's named after his mother, Rebbetzin Chana Weingarten. Right next door. So he arranges, they're going to get these Jews out of Cuba, out of Havana. Castro gave permission. The only problem is, the day that he gave permission for them to leave is Yom Kippur. And he calls the Rav, Rebbe, what should I do? Yom Kippur. And the Rav tells him, call me back in 2 hours. He calls back the Rav in 2 hours and he says, get them out by all means, on Yom Kippur. The Rav quotes the Chafetz Chaim, Pikuach Nefesh, spiritual Pikuach Nefesh, Daicha Kola Torah Kula, it's like illness. Get them out. Many years later, the Rav meets David Weingarten at some Mizrahi affair. And David Weingarten says to him, Rebbe, you recall? Of course. He says, why did you tell me to call back 2 hours later? And the Rav tells him, because I wanted to consult with the Baron Cutler. So it shows you the depth of the relationship. On the other side, when it came to shackling the animal, I write about this in the Suva era. But this part of the story I don't write about. I heard it from people who were there with the Rav at the time. It was in the RCO office. But the Rav knew that to be matir, I think it was a holding pen where the animal is upside down. It changes the way shchita was done throughout time immemorial, but al pi din, there's nothing wrong with it. But the Rav knew he had Reb Lezer Suva behind him. I write all the details in the Suva era. But he knew without Reb Aaron, it'll be a problem. So he called Reb Aaron and he pressed Reb Aaron. He wouldn't let Reb Aaron get away. You know, Reb Aaron is a Rosh Yeshiva. What's he involved with? The Rav had a dual existence. The Rav was a Rosh Yeshiva, but he also was a rabbi in Boston. He was chairman of the Halachic Commission of the RCA. So the Rav, willy-nilly, it's a word he taught us, willy-nilly, I saw that word, I heard the word on the radio, I heard it on a website just last night, I couldn't get over it. I see everyone has picked up the Rav's vocabulary. Willy-nilly, The Rav had to get involved in halacha lemaisa problems. So Reb Aaron, as you know with Erev, you know my Sunday classes, Rav Menachem Kasha says, Reb Aaron said to him, Ich bin nicht chalk, ich hab nicht given in the sugya viel yarn, I wasn't in the sugya many years, give me a chance to work it out. And according to Reb Menachem Kasha, before Reb Aaron could work it out, he died, he never got an answer. That's according to Reb Menachem Kasha. Okay? So the Rav wouldn't let Reb Aaron say to him, "Ich bin nicht in der Sugi, ich darf immer cooking." The Rav pushed him against the wall. I heard this from the Rabbanim, from the RCA, who were ear witnesses to the conversation. And what could Reb Aaron do? The Rav had him. He wasn't the happiest guy in the world to change the way they do shchita meidori dorit. By nature, Reb Aaron was reticent on a shaila like this. By nature, he was conservative with a small c. But the Rav pushed him against the wall. But what's fascinating is the Rav understood without Reb Aaron, his name will not carry enough weight. So the ultimate story, and it ends it all, and I end off the class, of course, is the famous story of the Leviah, which I've written about and I've spoken about, and people ask me and question, and there's so many people pulling, but it's look in Harpades, look what I quote, I write about it in the Suva era too, and I quote Harpades. Why do I quote Harpades? To defend myself. In other words, I don't want the world to say, yeah, Rakefet writes this because he's a YU graduate, he's a Mizrachist, he's open-minded, he's this, he's that. But when you quote the Rebbe Shmuel, you quote Rav Pardes in Rav Pardes, you're in right-wing territory. So no one can criticize me. If you want to criticize the Rav Pardes. But the ultimate story is Rav Aaron's funeral, where 25,000 people descend upon the Calvaria Synagogue on the east side before they ship the body off to Israel. and the Rabbarim's Talmidim take charge, and the swing to the right has already began, and they decide who can enter the synagogue and who can't. I'm telling you as it happened. So the Rav comes, they let him enter the synagogue, but they didn't ask him to speak. And it seems he had prepared notes in his pocket. He had notes prepared to speak. And it's a sad story. Marvin Schick, of course, comments on it that it's a very sad story, that for all Rabbaran's misgivings about Yeshiva University and the Mizrahi, but he knew who the Rav was. And the Rav knew who he was. And it's a sad story that the Talmidim didn't let the Rav be maspid among the other maspidim Rabbarim. But that's life, that's America, that's what has happened, that's what we live with, that's what challenges us. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we gotta go further, we have to be positive, and we have to be thankful for all that we have. Give me one more minute, just to end it off. I have a source here that no one else in the world has. A Talmud from this kollel, Rabbi Evan Abrahams, studied here in the late 90s, evidently went into the rabbinate for a while and didn't like the fact that Balabatim used their teeth to maledict rabbis, so he became a dentist. He pulls their teeth out today. So he got hold of a recording made at the OU in 1964. As far as I know, there's never been published. It's the Rav speaking. And he transcribed it from the Rav's talk. And he sent me a printout of what he transcribed. On page 16 of his transcription, he has the Rav talking about, I remember many years ago there was a problem in Albany about integrating the program of the day schools. So then at the request of Rav Aaron Cutler Zichrono Levracha, I spoke to one of the leading educators in the state of New York, and I explained to him why we have to teach Talmud in the morning, not in the late afternoon. And if I'm not mistaken, what the Rav is referring to is time and again, this happened in the 30s, it happened, again in the 50s, it will not happen today in New York because Satmar owns New York City, but at that time, the Board of Education, what people who run the school systems, were a little bit upset with the yeshiva. When do they do their secular studies, their general studies? 1 o'clock in the afternoon. 1 o'clock in the afternoon to a non-Torah head. Kid wakes up, goes to school 9 to 1. By 1 o'clock, he's dead tired. How much can he concentrate? They don't know what life is like for us. I'm a Yibanei Shalom for 70 years. I've been studying 10, 12, 14, 16 hours a day. Who gets tired? Knowledge, Torah, secular studies. We don't get tired. But a Gentile kid gets tired. So they start putting pressure on the yeshivas to do integration. 1 hour Talmud, 1 hour math, 1 hour Bible, 1 hour geography, etc., etc. Don't leave the general studies for when the kid is daydreaming. And the Rav testified, I know exactly what the Rav is referring to, Rabbaran, who didn't speak English, but he asked the Rav, would your masterful command of English and how to speak to educators plead our case and explain to them why Talmud comes first and our kids will be more than happy at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to do their high school studies. My dear students, to reiterate, what did we do today? All right, first of all, we publicized a book that, I would love to give a course on this book. There's so many, it's a simple read, it's a memoir, but the issues he raises are the issues that all of us have to deal with. What's fascinating about the book, if you come from Brooklyn, you're going to love it. It's like my reading a book about the Bronx. And if you come from Torah Vadas, you will love it three times over because he has all the personalities from Torah Vadas. It's a beautiful memoir. There's in there about his own family some bitterness, which you read and understand. My problem is that one of the prominent names that he's bitter about, I just met the man at Leil Shabbat, Shidat Shabbat, a few weeks ago, and I met the guy, and I don't want to go further. And then I pick up this book. Then I have a classmate who's from that same family, and I'm looking to meet him on the streets of Jerusalem and say to him, did you see your cousin's book, A Sukkah is Burning? Also, I throw out a puzzle to you when you get the book. Is this picture right, or is the picture inverted? And prove to me why am I uncertain that the picture is inverted, and there may very well be a technical reason why they couldn't publish the real picture. Rakefik has an entire theory certified by his wife that he is correct. We went into the whole question, and it's a sad question, it's an inevitable question. Who do we choose? Imagine they captured this classroom. God have mercy, what we have gone through. Remember in Tzfat in the 70s, they captured a school. Obama's friends who were dealing with the left-wing Jewish liberals, their friends, guts all uphitten, how perverted some minds are. But anyway, let it be. Maybe they're right, I don't know. Do I know everything? Of course not. Shocking. Anyway, coming back here, imagine they captured this class. And they say, well, we're going to do a gesture. Of course, we checked out your rabbi never harmed a fly. So we're going to release the rabbi and three students that he chooses. Okay, do I have to go further? What do you do? Do I choose? And if I don't choose, everyone is killed. And if I choose, and there's no time to do a Goral Hagra here. They gave me 5 minutes. Choose three. Who do you choose? I hate to say it, you know how I would choose? The three youngest people in the class. That's what I would choose. Okay? Am I right or wrong? Of course I'm not right. Am I wrong? Think about it. That's the way I view the situation. The Gemara from Shanghai saw it with your own eyes. What the Juni brothers told me, one brother sitting here, one brother through the telephone, you're absolutely right. Living proof. Right there. Who was right? Rav Aaron, his daughter-in-law, the extra money. Very interesting, Ami magazine. Marvin Schick, relations between the Rav and Rav Aaron. I think we've said it all. That I don't know of. Did they interact more and more? I mean, on public issues, I don't think so. I think those issues that we touched upon were the public issues that they remained friendly. Absolutely. That they had different hashkafa, translate. Absolutely. What's next? Post-World War II. I'm going to introduce you to new material. First witness accounts. And we're going to come back in retrospect to 43, as you will see, with some very fascinating information. But we leave that for next week. Sunday? Menashe Klein defending his right to differ with Reb Moshe Feinstein. More proof that Reb Menashe carries the day. Wow. A neighbor from Brooklyn, with all due respect to the Satmar Beis Din and all the other Rabbanim who are Machshir, put up a sign. This Erev was made possible through the Lamdanut, and let's put it this way, the guts and courage of one man, Reb Menashe HaKatan Klein. You don't want to carry, that's your choice, but the Erev is here. Imagine if you had an Erev and they could solve all the problems of coming to hear Chazan Moshe Aisha on Shabbos. Does anyone know how they solved it in the Frum shuls where people cared, particularly in other parts of Brooklyn, East New York, etc.? A chazan they had to have. You bought the ticket, you didn't get a ticket. You got a red bindle, somewhat like you get at Kevah Rachel. You wore it around your wrist. And when you came to the door, they looked, oh, a hotta bindle, a kenarayim gain. Yeah, I'm not such a glatta solution. I'm well aware of it. We dealt with that in the Sunday class with going out with a covering on your hat. The freebies. Number one, if anyone wants, I gave this out last year. It's by Eli Sadan on serving the privilege, the right, the chovah, to serving the Israeli army. Sources. Rav Eli Sadan is the founder of the pre-army yeshivat, fabulous individual. This is Misrad HaChinuch. I quoted it yesterday. If anyone wants it, it's a beautiful little volume on Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad. Anyone named Yosef Chaim? I got one for my grandson because his name is Rabbi Yosef Chaim. An unbelievable picture picked up by Chaim Meifelman of the Bavava Rebbe, a Mitzri Hirsch Meislish, a Mechutin with the Satmar Rebbe, dancing together at a wedding. And take a look the way weddings were in the early 50s, the Hasidisha men and women standing together, intermingled and mixed, watching the two Rebbeim dance. It was a different world. Well, we mentioned in class, none is too many about Canada and the way they've turned away Jews. Hatolet Soeket. This is one of the Pasquilers against the Baron Leib Steinman. It's unbelievable what goes on here. This is for Yitz Rubin, Rabbi Rachman. Was he Orthodox or wasn't he Orthodox? Unbelievable. The Sperm blog on the Vilna Gaon once again. Some of this is outlandish. What scholars can come up with, what they can think. 1 second. We have more and more and more. You want to look at that, take it. This, no one wanted yesterday, Chabad. YU goes to Chabad. All the pictures of the YU fellas at Chabad. Your relatives. This is from the Rebbe, very moving. It's, the Rebbe gave a talk about homosexuality or an interview. They wrote it up, and the Rebbe made corrections on the manuscript. Look at it carefully.
In English.
You'll see where he tones down what he said publicly. Fabulous. Very fabulous. Anyone who wants why you is shaking, rabbinical student who held partnership minyan service will get ordination. They back down. Oh. Why you back down?
They're going to give it to him.
Yeah, they're going to give it to him. There's the article. Here is Rabbi Yol Khan. Very interesting. Chabad. If you do a mitzvah without any inspiration, without any kavana, do you get credit for it? See what he has to say. It's a typical Chabad approach. 1,000 Jewish teens to spend Shabbat in Crane Heights. See what Chabad tells them. If they're not Shomer Shabbos, what would you say to them? They're going to be there for Shabbat. And here's the information about the attempt to form a university, and you'll see one of the bloggers says, why do you think they discovered something new? Rabbi Rakefitz spoke about this years ago. So Baruch Hashem, people are listening. If anyone wants the photographs from Sitter is Burning, here are the photographs.
Can you make a copy of the 16 pages of the transcription of the OU?
You have to write it down and give it to me. I have to find where I put it. But a lot of it is not clear. He couldn't understand the rough clearly, so be aware. Anyway, we got to watch the clock. The class is coming in until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vedanya.